Today, a psalm to help us with the virtue least attained by Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So, of course, the virtue I'm speaking of is humility. And I pick on Benjamin Franklin only because, in truth, his awareness of the difficulty of obtaining humility with any sense of actually maintaining that humility is insightful. It's helpful. And this psalm really does address one of the most fundamental realities of the contrast between what we think we gain in our religiosity, in our ability to accomplish the righteousness of God, and the righteousness God actually expects us to have is profound. It's present in this passage in such a great way. And so that's what I want us to notice. And when I mentioned Benjamin Franklin, you know, the quotations that are most frequently associated with him are the ones that immediately pop up if you ask. And I did, Googling Benjamin Franklin and the virtue of humility, because I wanted a quick reference to the quotations, because it's not our focus today to talk about him. But they really are brilliant quotations. One, he says, "I cannot boast of much success in acquiring the reality of this virtue, humility, but I had a good deal with regard to the appearance of it." This is a joke I made with a friend of mine years ago, which was when he said to me, "Well, I think you have some feigned humility." My response to him was, "Well, better feigned than none at all," which is not true, obviously. I mean, and he was joking and I was joking also, but it's the same joke Benjamin Franklin is making. You know, I've got a good deal of experience pretending to have humility. That'll have to do. The other side of it is this reality about pride, if you take it from the other side, which this psalm is just filled with. We're doing the 86th psalm today. But Benjamin Franklin's statement about it was, "You will see pride," this is the thing he's actually talking about, "perhaps often in this history that he was writing, for even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome it, pride, I should probably be proud of my humility." And then finally, in his list of virtues, the way Benjamin Franklin describes humility when he tacks it on to the end of his list is to say this last virtue would be humility, which to him is, "Imitate Jesus and Socrates." That's his daily way of reminding himself what humility would be about, which is a fair description of it. Imitate Jesus, obviously. We would all stick with that one. And Socrates. Socrates, the one who basically describes his own knowledge as an awareness of how much he doesn't know, that the more you know, the more you actually realize you don't know. Or as I would say it, the better aware we are of how deeply we can stare into the black abyss of our own ignorance, if you want to put it more darkly. Anyway, the point is there's a lot to be gained in recognizing how important humility is and how difficult it is for us to acknowledge that we actually need more of it, because even then we seem to gain some pride and lift ourselves up as those who, unlike those pigs over there, have finally obtained humility, and in so acknowledging, lose it. You know what I'm saying? So I just want to take this psalm and sort of go through it in a way. I don't think there's anything I'm going to say here we wouldn't all know is true, but again, it's just so slippery. It's like that's the, you know, I remember having kids chasing around the ballpark at Arlington And it was a different, there was also a different stadium for the Rangers back in those days, Arlington Stadium. And this was back before the PETA days were quite as aggressive or well accepted as they are now. And we would have little kids chasing greased pigs around the stadium. And that was, you know, the games we played before the Rangers played their game. And so you'd have these little kids chasing a pig around, trying to grab it. And, you know, that's the pig. That's the one we want. All the kids are chasing it. Kid would grab it, and you'd think they had it, and the pig would wiggle loose because, you know, it was covered with grease. And so they weren't going to be able to pick up the pig. This is what humility's like. Oh, there it is. I've got it. And it slips out. And it's, I don't have it. Another kid's going to have to grab it. Even though everything I'm going to say to you today, I hope, is just plainly and obviously true, for those who've studied enough of Christianity and enough of what Christ has said and enough of the Psalms and enough of the minor prophets to realize what God actually expects of us, you know, if we've given ourselves to it at all, we'll know these things. But man, is it hard to hang on to. It just squeals and runs away again. And so I just want to take us a step at a time, three sections through this psalm to understand what those things are again and sort of remind ourselves of a need to pursue truly the righteousness of God and not the thing that we tend to attribute to ourselves as righteousness, even among those of us who really care about getting it right. So starting in the first verse, now this is a psalm of David. This is how it's headed for us in the superscript. So it's a psalm of David. But here's how the psalm begins in earnest in verse 1. Incline your ear, Yahweh, O Lord, and answer me, because I am poor and needy. So I'm coming and asking for God's mercy. Verse 2. Preserve my life, because I am godly. Now, this is, again, we can use these words freely because they're true of the Messiah. And the Messiah, when he prays it, it's just the case that he is godly. And in this case, the word is important, but I'll come back to the word in just a moment. First, I want to read through the first 7 verses to get what we're talking about here. But so you can hear the Messiah praying this, and because it's true of him, it's true of his people, and because it's true of his people, it's true of me, because I am included in him. So I can pray the prayer for that reason. So we acknowledge this, but there's more to clarifying the meaning of the prayer than just that. I'll show it in just a second. Show you in just a second. So the statement is, though, preserve my life because, for I am godly. He goes on in verse 2 to say, save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Be gracious to me, Yahweh, O Lord, Adonai, actually. For to you do I cry all the day. Gladden the soul of your servant, because to you, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love, key term, to all who call upon you. Give ear, O Lord, Yahweh, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. In the day of my trouble, I call upon you because you answer me. You're the one I can depend on. And that is sort of the focus of this section, the first 7 verses of this psalm, that we need, you know, faithful people, godly people in verse 2, godly people still need help. And the one to trust is Yahweh, is God. And that's really the focus in this psalm in the first section, that God is the one who ought to be trusted. And the way that starts to show up for us in this first section is in the description of the one who's calling out to God and saying, the justification for my calling on you and counting on help is that I am godly. And again, for us, we immediately run to the conclusion that he's saying, ooh, look how upright I am. Look how powerful I am in my ability to do all of the right things and none of the wrong things, equating it with the word righteous, which is not wrong, but also misleading because of what we do with the word righteous. When he says he is godly, he's using the word hasid, which you'll associate with the word I'm going to say in a minute, hesed, which I just said was an emphatically important word in this psalm, down in verse 5, because God, Yahweh, is abounding in hesed, steadfast love. And they're not identical in meaning, but you can tell they have the same root. They have the same base. And the hesed, or hasid in this case, is a word that's used commonly. And it's just, I mean, it's used in a variety of ways, but it's always pointing to godliness as the person who is kind and who is faithful. But it's faithful in that sense that they're not, they don't give up the commission that God has given to us in his covenant to be this kind of person, a person who is kind, who is considerate of others. And it's not just here in this psalm, and it's not just in the psalms that this is the case. In the Old Testament, and David is the principal model of this in the Old Testament, it is the whole point that that's the kind of character a person has that God is looking for, a person after God's own heart, the way David is described. We're often puzzled. How can he say David is a man after his own heart when he behaves this way or that way? And it's because ultimately the whole test of a person's character for whether they're this kind of person or not is whether they are this kind of kind, this kind of merciful or not. So in the words that David gives to it when he sings, and this shows up in Psalm 18, I'm going to take it from 2 Samuel 22 because I want it from the moment in David's life when he sings this psalm. But it's the same thing as Psalm 18. You can go back to the episodes that where we were covering earlier psalms and hear it there. But in 2 Samuel 22, David, when he's been delivered from Saul's hand, and he's really been delivered from all of his enemies, but all of that comes to Saul's history. And so it describes it as David's song when God delivered him from Saul. It describes it this way, starting in verse 25 of 2 Samuel 22, "The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness." Now, here's his righteousness. And again, if you put it in the context of this psalm, Psalm 86, "Answer me because I'm poor and needy, preserve my life because I am godly." But what is that righteousness? This is what he says in 2 Samuel 22. "God has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his sight." What is that? "With the merciful, you show yourself merciful." Now, he gives other words to it, too, and these are all important. They all carry a weight to them, and none of this is intended to imply that the things that are described, like murder, don't matter. Well, it doesn't matter if you murder, as long as you're merciful. Obviously, this is what it means to fulfill that table of the commandments, as we would put it in the Anabaptist influence. "With the merciful, you show yourself merciful." This is how he says it in 2 Samuel 22. "With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless." And again, these words all come to a specific meaning. "With the purified, you deal purely." And with, and this is the only contrast that's given, "and with the crooked, you make yourself seem crooked." That is tortuous. We can't deal squarely with it because we're cheating. We don't know what you're going to do with us. "You save a humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty, the proud, to bring them down." That's the contrast. On the side of the wicked, there is simply the crooked, the person who's not honest, but instead deals one way with himself and a different way with others, or one way with the people he likes and a different way with everyone else. And he's manipulating, and he's gaining, and he's building, and he's acquiring. And the contrast with that is the person who's merciful, the person who is merciful because, honestly, he's humble. He recognizes where he is himself. This is why, if you look for these summary passages in the Old Testament, and I'm not just saying we cherry pick the ones that we want, but if we go to the summary passages of the Old Testament that Jesus cherry picks, to use the same language, meaning if you go to Jesus and say, well, what really matters, Jesus picks these passages, the Micah 6:8 passages. But in this case, I'll go to the one in Hosea 6 where he's talking to people and saying, you do all of these other things, and that's not what God wants. He showed you exactly what he wants, but in this case, in Hosea 6, it comes about like this. Now, just so you know the conclusion of it, this is the one where Jesus quotes Hosea 6:6. "I desired mercy," Jesus says, "and not sacrifice." That's what God wants. In Hosea 6, it's translated this way in the ESV, "For I desired steadfast love." This is that same hesed we were just talking about in a moment that gets repeated in the psalm over and over, and it's repeated throughout the Old Testament. But I desired steadfast love, not sacrifice. I desired the knowledge of God rather than the burnt offerings you were wanting to bring to me. This is Hosea 6:6. But the way he leads into verse 6 in Hosea 6 is this. What am I going to do with you, Ephraim? What am I going to do with you, Judah? Israel, Judah, both halves? What am I going to do with those of you who are supposed to be my people? Your love, you come to me, you bow down before me, you offer your sacrifices, you exercise your worship, your liturgy. Your love is like a morning cloud. This is what Hosea 6 says. It's like the dew that goes away early. Oh, you just cover the grass with your moisture, and by the time the sun comes up, it's gone again. Therefore, I've cut you down with the prophets. I have slain you with the words of my mouth, and my judgment goeth forth as the light. This time it's not even an actual scythe that he's taking to the people, you know, as in the case where he's judging Jerusalem after David's hypocrisy of counting the people and things like that. It's not like that. This is just him saying, why am I using my prophets to hew down your righteousness with these words of judgment? Why am I doing that? Because your love is false. You're offering sacrifices, but you're not giving what I wanted. What did I want? Chassid, in this case, hesed. I wanted you to be in my covenant. I wanted mercy, not sacrifice. The thing he's looking for is the thing he offers in himself. God is asking for his people to trust him, and in that trust to recognize that they're receiving from God the thing he's willing to give to those who are humble. And so as we read through the rest of that section down through verse 7, that's what the psalmist is doing. Look, I'm in trouble. I need help. I trust in you. You're my God. I need your grace. I cry out to you all day long. Lord, you're the one to whom I lift up my soul because you're good and forgiving, abounding in hesed to all who call upon you. So give ear, Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. So in the first place, I just want to point out that when people are righteous, when they are godly, when they are pious, even when they're doing nothing but being kind, doing everything they're supposed to do, they still need help from God. We still need God to be merciful and kind. And God is the only one we can count on for that help because God is the one to trust. That's the first part of the psalm. God is the one to trust, not our own righteousness. When David prays this prayer and says, I'm being pious, his prayer isn't like that voice that I just used. His prayer is, God, I have been what you asked, and I still need help. I need you to come to my rescue. That's because faithful people still need God's help. Not good enough. God is the one to trust, not ourselves, not others. God is the one to trust. Okay, that's where we begin, verses 1 through 7. Now we start in verse 8 with the second section where this is the reason God is the one to trust, because he's so great, right? He's so powerful. That also means God is the one to fear, as you'll see in this section. So in verse 8, there's none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made, love putting all those other gods in their place. They didn't make their own nations. Now, we know he's mocking them. It's not like these gods actually exist. Or if he's referring to spiritual entities in some way, these are the demons that take over this place of dominion or authority. But they don't own it. God created the nations that worship other gods over them. They should be worshiping Yahweh, the one who actually is the God of their creation. It's a really insulting statement to the other gods, right? So there's none like you among the other gods. They're just these minions who show up and try to claim little things that you had to create. So there's none like you among the gods, Yahweh, nor are there any works like yours. That's actually Adonai again. All the nations you've made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name, because you are great. You do wondrous things. You alone are actually God. There's one creator and one maintainer. There's only one who's worthy of worship. There's only one who does those great things. Given more time, I will point you to this. I would read it to you. Psalm 89, if you really want to affirm this. And we'll get to Psalm 89 in a few Psalms. But Psalm 89, starting in verse 5 and just down through verse 11, make the point of how unique God is among everything else, because he's the one who creates everything and exercises power over all of those things, dry land and sea and so on. It's a really great passage coming in that Psalm, Psalm 89, 5 through 11. But in that point, the point is, at the end of that section, he says, the heavens are yours, in verse 11 of Psalm 89. The earth also is yours, the world and all that is in it. And the point is, because you founded them. So in this Psalm, verse 11, he says, teach me your way, Yahweh, so that I can walk in your truth. Unite my heart. My heart is divided right now. I'm afraid of this person and this event and that event. What's going to happen this way and that way? My heart is divided among all of these different allegiances it has because it has all of these different fears. So unite my heart so that I only fear you. Unite my heart to fear your name. And this is the place we want to end up, fearing God. So he goes on in verse 12 to say, I give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with my whole heart. It's united in you. And I will glorify your name forever, because great is your chesed, steadfast love, toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Hades itself, from Sheol, the grave, the place of the dead. You have delivered my soul from that thing I used to fear most, the one that in the book of Hebrews is pointed out to us as the thing that because of our fear of it has held us captive our entire lives. All of our fears are divided until they're finally united in the only thing that we ought to fear, which is Yahweh himself. That this is, you know, it's weird for people to think that we're supposed to fear God. So we convert it. We convert it to language of reverence. Well, it doesn't really mean fear God. I've said many times before, and I'll say many other times, there's no equivocation about the term in Scripture or about whoever is offering the fear to God. We fear God because he's frightening. His power is overwhelming. He can do anything he wants to do. And in our fear of God, we realize there's no reason to fear anything else. This is why we can still use the language of the New Testament, 2 Timothy 1, for instance, where we don't have a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. That is true about us. But it's not true that we're supposed to take that to mean that we no longer have to fear God. You know, when this passage comes into the New Testament, it comes into the New Testament as fearing God and the king. This is the thing. And why is that? Because we don't know what God is going to do, as we'll see in just a few minutes when we get to the end of the psalm. So in the middle section of the psalm, we have obtained this awareness, that not only in the beginning of the psalm, that God is the one we ought to trust, but now that God is the one we ought to fear. He is unique among the gods. He is the one with all of the power. And so we trust him. His mercy makes it so that we can trust him. His faithfulness and mercy also make us aware that he's the one we fear and that it's okay to fear him because he also has chesed. He also has steadfast love toward us. Okay, fine. We're all good. Now we get to verse 14. The end of the psalm comes like this. O God, and this is imprecatory. You know, it's a prayer for God to curse the wicked. And it's an important prayer. It's a prayer that's prayed throughout all of history, in Israel's history, all the way up to the New Testament. How long, Lord, until you avenge our adversaries? We're praying that all the way into the New Testament. So it's not wrong. David's not wrong for praying this. But what is important is that we understand the sense with which we have to pray it. So verse 14, O God, insolent men have risen up against me. A band of ruthless men seeks my life, and they do not set you before them. They're not godly. They have no concern about you whatsoever, and they're out to get me. So what does he say in verse 15? That's verse 14. God, these wicked men have risen up against me, and they don't care about you, and they're trying to take me down. Verse 15, you, O Lord. Now, this is what I would expect in the next verse. You, Lord, are a judgmental God, and you hate people like that. And so you will destroy those wicked men. And it's a reasonable, that would be a reasonable prayer, and it's not untrue. He is a great God of judgment. You know, he's able to do that. But this is not where the psalm goes. Verse 15, it goes where we need it to go. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious. The thing he does with that turn in this psalm, and there's no way to miss this in the discourse, the way the passage flows, the way the ideas flow, that he puts the insolent men on one side as out to get him. They're out to destroy me. They're wicked because of their effort to destroy me, which, by the way, is the contrast with being a pious man, with being a person who is hasid. The way we talk about the Hasidic Jews, that's that word, right? So the idea is, but they use it differently. You know, now that means basically orthodox, old-style righteousness, you know, is how they're thinking of it. This is the actual word used in the Old Testament. This is the perfect contrast with it. These people are out to destroy me. That's on in verse 14. That's who's on one side of me. They're seeking to destroy my life, and they don't care about you. They don't even remember you. In contrast to that, we would expect him to say, so God, come up behind them and trip them. You know, come up behind them and grab them by the neck and throw them into hell for me. Do your job as a judge. But instead, he doesn't. He doesn't say how God should relate to the wicked. He says how God relates to all of us in verse 15. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Now, if he were talking about how God is going to relate to the wicked, that's the last thing in the world we want to remember about God. I need God to show up angry and do something to the wicked. Take them down, you know, cut them off at the knees. But you're a really patient God. This is not going to help at all. But he's not relating God to the wicked. He's relating God to himself and to the wicked, because God's the same. Whether he's dealing with us or the wicked, God is still God. And who is he? He's a merciful and gracious God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. So in verse 16, he's not asking God to do something to them. He's asking God to do something with him. I need help because of what those people are doing who don't care a rip about you, God. So what do I need? I need you and the way you relate to me. So in verse 16, turn to me and be gracious to me. Give your strength to your servant and save the son of your maidservant. That line, the son of your maidservant, is just one of the greatest lines in the Old Testament. It's used quite a bit. And I've talked about it before, you know, when we've talked about the 116th Psalm. It's probably my favorite line in that psalm as well. And so I won't dwell on it here much, but I mean, this statement, this is what compels. It doesn't just invite, it forces us to a confrontation with what the point of this psalm is. Because what we're thinking at this point is, look, I'm pious, I'm godly, and so I'm asking you, God, to come and help me, and you owe it to me. I'm pious, I trust you, and I'm supposed to trust you, so you would come and help me. After all, I fear you. You're the only true God, and you're a God who deserves to be feared, and I fear you, so I know you'll come and help me. And then look at these wicked people over here. They deserve to be judged. Those are terrible people. You, though, are a merciful and faithful God, and you're gracious, and you take a long time to get angry, and so you're patient. So I know you'll be good with me because I'm so pious. No. When we read that phrase, save the son of your maidservant, we think of it the way we think of it when he says, give strength to your servant. Hey, I serve you. I'm pious. I'm godly. I'm the son of your maidservant. Well, that's a weird idiom, but it must just mean he serves God. It's not that. It's an appeal to Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael and all the people that Israel would look at as, yeah, they're brothers, but brothers who've betrayed them. It's, if you took it to Jacob and Esau, you know, it's Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. This is the outcast, the one who was thrown out into the desert. But the one who was thrown out into the desert, and I'm going to try to avoid getting into the whole story here because you remember the story. I mean, Sarah, remember, she finally has a baby with Abraham and seeing Isaac and loving him and wanting him to be blessed. She's jealous of Hagar and Ishmael, and she wants Ishmael cast out. And she tells Abraham, cast Ishmael out. And Abraham's like, well, he's still my son. I don't want to do this. And God says to him, it's okay, Abraham. You can listen to your selfish, envious, jealous, he doesn't say any of those things, wife, and throw this baby out. You can do that because I'm going to take care of Ishmael. I'm going to bless him. It's going to be the, as he said in other places, he'll be the father of 12 princes and so on. He's going to bless Ishmael. The whole line that somehow or another Ishmael is evil and the descendants of Ishmael are evil because they're not the promised one, that's completely contemporary political reading into what the scriptures actually say about Ishmael, which is that God's going to bless him. This enemy of Israel later, this one who they see as such a threat, as such an outsider, as so unclean, they're Gentiles. They're not even Jewish. They're not Hebrew. They're Gentiles. That's the one David identifies himself with. When he comes to God to ask for help, he doesn't say, give your strength to your servant because I'm so worthy as your servant. I'm so faithful. He clarifies it, and he makes it clear to everyone. Israel takes up this psalm, Psalm 86. They sing it in worship together. They all know what this refers to. As a nation, they are supposed to lift up their voice to the God they trust and the God they fear in the face of enemies who are persecuting them and say to God, we're asking for your help in the same way that your maidservants, Hagar's son, would call out to you and ask for help. I know we don't deserve to be called by your name. That's what we're saying. I know I don't deserve to be identified as your son, but I have nowhere else to turn, and so I'm asking for help. It is, I think obliquely, probably one of the things that's supposed, an allusion, at least an echo, when Jesus tells the prodigal son story, that other son that comes back, because he does it in his behavior, you know, when he makes himself so unclean and so on, he's eating the husks that the swine would eat, all that stuff. When he's so unclean, that uncleanness is in the context of these pristine Jews looking at these dirty people who are coming to Jesus and being accepted by him and saying, why are you accepting them? In the context of that story, he has this younger, this prodigal son, as we refer to him, coming back to the father and saying, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. That's this line. I am the son of your maidservant. I don't deserve to be included among those who would inherit your wealth. I'm just this one you should be ashamed of. But I'm asking for your help. And the only reason I think I might receive it is because you are a God merciful and gracious and slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Because when we read this without recognizing that, we miss the whole point when we get to, you know, verse 17 and we talk about those who hate me, put them to shame because of, you know, what you do and in their judgment. We miss the whole point of this, that we deserve exactly the same thing, that we are in exactly the same position. This is why, if you put it again in the context of the New Testament, that parable that Jesus gives in Matthew 18 is so important. I have it printed right here. I want to read the whole parable to you. I'm going to read you the parable. It's just too good not to read. The kingdom of heaven, understanding who we are in the presence of God. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who was going to settle accounts with his servants. And when he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. That's an immeasurable amount of money. It's a ridiculous amount of money. It's like saying he owed him $1 trillion. And since he could not pay, of course, his master ordered him to be sold. He deserves it. He owes him $1 trillion and he can't pay him back, with his wife and his children and all that he had, and payment to be made. But the servant, he fell on his knees and imploring him, said, "Have patience with me, and I'll pay you everything." And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. "You'll never be able to pay me this amount, but I'll still let you off." But when that same servant who was forgiven a debt he could never have paid, went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, and seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, "Pay what you owe." So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, obviously in exactly the same way the original one pleaded, right? "Have patience with me and I'll pay you." And he owes him just a few dollars. I mean, nothing. And he refused. And he went and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. And when his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were distressed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. And then the master summoned him and said to him, "You wicked servant, I forgave you this enormous debt because you pleaded with me. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant, don't you think? Like I had mercy on you." And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he would pay all of his debt. So also Jesus says, this is how Jesus puts it, pretty harsh. "So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you don't forgive your brother from your heart." So in verse 17, when David says, "Show me a sign of your favor, that so that those who hate me see and are put to shame because you, Lord, have helped me and comforted me." Not even because you went out and judged them, but because you were merciful to me. So that even when we are oppressed, we seek mercy for us, not judgment on them. And this is in the model of the Old Testament psalm. Even when we're being oppressed, we seek mercy for us, not judgment on them. Even when judgment on them is legitimate and will come, I understand our tendency to wish that we could be universalists, that everybody ends up redeemed. I don't think the scripture leaves us that option. People are going to be judged. So why wouldn't we celebrate in their judgment? We don't have that prerogative. Throughout scripture, our position is to seek mercy for us and to leave the judging to God. We're not pursuing that. We're just seeking for mercy on us, and that's how the psalm puts it. The contrast is not between us and the wicked. "Look how pious I am, and look how they don't even care about you." The contrast is between God and them and between God and us. In this particular psalm, they are destroying while God is preserving. But also, looking at us, in our best, when we're pious, we're poor and needy. That's how verse 1 describes the psalmist. "I'm poor and needy, but I'm pious." We're poor and needy, while God is doing wondrous things in verse 10. The closest we get to being like God is when we are, in the word godly, this is imitating God, pious, when we are kind. When we are faithful, constant in that practice. That's why in that Psalm 18 that I was talking about, where David is celebrating, you know, his escape from Saul, and he thanks God for doing it. And he says in verse 28 of 2 Samuel 22, "You save a humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them down." So we love to think of ourselves as, you know, being the ones who are able to say, "You help us because we're so desperate and therefore we're so humble. Look how humble we are, God. You're bound to help us, right?" And we love to think this way. You bring down all those arrogant people around us who are seeking our destruction and they're seeking their own gain. Those wicked, terrible people. We don't even consider the possibility that when we believe others deserve judgment, but we don't, we're putting ourselves above them. Who's proud now? I mean, that's the point. That's why Proverbs 24, exactly the same lesson. Again, Old Testament passage, crystal clear. Proverbs 24, verse 15. Don't lie in wait like a wicked man against the dwelling of the righteous. Do no violence to his home, because the righteous falls seven times and rises again. But the wicked stumble in times of calamity. Ooh, well, I'll be careful not to stand against the righteous then, because they would overcome it anyway. I'll just make sure I stand against the wicked. That's not the point. Verse 17. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles, because Yahweh may see it and be displeased and turn away his anger from him. You don't even have a position where you can look at somebody who is being judged and say, oh, they deserved it. Can't even do that without recognizing that you're now putting yourself in the position above them, which is the place God likes to knock people off of. You know, that's what he does. So verse 19, don't fret yourself because of evildoers. Don't be envious of the wicked. The evil man doesn't have a future. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. God knows what he's doing. My son, fear Yahweh and the king. Just like 1 Peter says, fear God, honor the king, right? My son, fear the Lord and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise, because disaster, this is coming from God, disaster will arise suddenly from them, God and the king. And who knows the ruin that will come from them both? Who knows whether you're included in that sweeping judgment or not? So if you put in that passage, Proverbs 24, if you want to go back and look at it, you can figure out what I mean by these verses going together. But if you put verse 15, don't lie in wait against the wicked, together with verse 19, don't fret yourself because of evildoers, it is don't presume that you know the difference between the righteous, who deserve protection, and then the wicked, who we want to judge. We're not in a position to make that determination. We don't get to pick who's tare, who's wheat. We don't get to do that. And if you put verses 17 together with the end of it, verse 17, do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, that statement. If you put that together with the end of that section in Proverbs, you know, fear the Lord and the king. Who knows the ruin that's going to come from both of them? That means don't presume not to deserve the same judgment that you see a wicked man in your eyes receiving. We're not different. All we're left with in this whole psalm, and I'll be done, all we're left with, even in the pursuit of righteousness, is God's chesed, his faithful mercy, imitated by our chassid, our godliness, which is demonstrated in faithful kindness, which we're able to demonstrate because we properly fear what God would do to us if he gave us what we deserve. But we trust what God will do to us because in the way we treat others, we show that we actually do only fear and trust him.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.